Thank you for that very kind introduction, and also thank you for being here tonight. I know you have better things to do, probably, whether you're young or old. I can talk to the old. I'm 70 myself. I've been here a long time. Seen a lot. Thank you for having me here in Canada. It's been wonderful so far. It's my first time back in a while, and my usual trips to Canada are much further west, places like Calgary and so forth. I love fishing. Fly fishing in particular, trout in particular, and so Canada is a welcome spot to come to. And I spend a lot of time in northern Idaho, right next to the Canadian border, and often wonder why I can't just walk across it like we used to. Oh, you all know the reasons why. Thank you for having me at this august institution, too. I understand it's fairly young, but doing some really innovative things. And one of the things I want to do is try to marry its actions up with some people I know who are doing similar things in the States and maybe begin to deal a little better with the incredible challenges that confront us in this century, not least of which, in fact, foremost of which, is the climate changing. I picked up a newspaper this morning and saw that something I didn't know to this point, and maybe you didn't either, because they really have not been destructive so far. We are now looking at the fifth Category 5 storm in the Pacific in this year. It's approaching 180 miles per hour winds right now. And if it continues to Japan and continues in that force, we may have a real problem. So far, it's run across the Marianas and abated somewhat and didn't do a whole lot of damage. But you see a problem that is real in our faces, so to speak, and that, for example, the United States military is focusing on increasingly. What happens if you have a 10-year storm or a 100-year storm that is one that usually in the past only occurred every century, every 10 years? You just, factor of 5, 6, 7, depending on whether you react to it or not, your budget for disaster relief. You just multiplied Indonesia's problems in 2005-06 and Japan's later with Fukushima Daiichi and the typhoon. You just multiplied that to the tune of 10 times. So you better have a lot of money put away for disaster relief, disaster assistance, humanitarian operations, and so forth. That's just one of the complications, the challenges that confronts us. But what I wanted to talk to tonight with you about, partly because you requested it, and partly because I'm tired of talking about the midterm elections. Blood from a turnip is what the State Department gets, you know. I want to talk about, the title is Travails of Empire. And let me start by disabusing you of any idea I'm associated with the U.S. Department of State, except to have their lovely representatives escort me and host me. This is not opinion of the government. This is my opinion. It's an opinion that comes from 31 years in service in the United States Army. It's an opinion that comes from time as an erstwhile diplomat and roughly 40 years of service to my country. I love my country. I am a diehard patriot for my country, but it's not my belief that my country right or wrong. My belief is that my country is right when it's right, and when it's wrong, I will do everything to change it. And so that's the spirit in which I'm here tonight, because you are some of the dearest friends and allies the United States has ever had, even when you go back to when we were trying to take you away from Britain. I mean that sincerely. So what do I mean? Let's first say, why do I call the United States of America an empire? People contest that. My students contest that. Are we imperial? Are we imperial in a new fashion? My students will usually come back and say, yes, we agree with you, Professor, but only in a sense of commercial enterprise. Many have said the most important phrase in our Constitution is nothing in the Bill of Rights. It's nothing that is often quoted. It's the Commerce Clause. We are a trading nation par excellence. We are the world's greatest trading nation. Indeed, post-World War II, our GDP was half the world's. We made 50,000 airplanes in a single year. We turned everything in America into war production. We didn't win the war by fighting astutely and competently on the plains of Europe, in France, or anywhere else. We won it by funding and logistically supplying the Soviets, who beat the Wehrmacht from Stalingrad to Berlin, and by funding and logistically supplying everyone else. Arguably, we did do some real fighting in the Pacific War. We did win that war, if you will, in this conventional sense. We were the arsenal for democracy because we were the most productive nation in the history of the world. There's little argument with that amongst experts who look at it and study it. We still are a great producing nation, just as is Canada, just as is Germany, Japan, and China, and so forth. But things have changed somewhat. But my students will agree that we are an imperial state in the sense of commercialism. And they will say, there's a McDonald's in every town. Or there's some other American instrument, U.S. instrument, in every town virtually. But I say, look at the signs that would reflect Rome, Britain, or any other past empire when empire and imperialism was in vogue, or the art of the day. Look at where we have our star troopers. Look at where we have our soldiers. We are everywhere. It depends on what day you look, but anywhere from 50 to 90 nations feature the presence of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. And in some cases, increasingly, largely because of piracy and so forth, our Coast Guard. If you look closely, you'll see we have been in Germany and in Japan, and Okinawa in particular, and in Korea for a half century, and have no design or purpose to leave, even now. Diminish our presence, perhaps, but not leave. And of course, Vladimir Putin has given us every reason to perhaps increase our presence. We are imperial. We are imperial and we are in decline. Part of this is because of our own complicity in bringing about that decline, bad decisions, bad foreign policy, strategically inept maneuvers in the world. And part of it, and we can argue, my students and I do, over what portion each shares, but part of it is the rise of others' power. Something that we strategically and otherwise planned for and helped post-World War II. We essentially told the Japanese, for example, you develop an export economy, we'll buy your products and we'll raise you out of the ashes which we created. And believe me, my Japanese colleagues who look back on Hiroshima and Nagasaki understand the nature of those ashes. That memory's dying, and that in itself is a political change element in the world, just as it's dying in Europe. Powell looked at me one day, Colin Powell looked at me, and he said, you know, Larry, very soon we will not have a Mitterrand, a John Major, a Maggie Thatcher, a Helmut Kohl, or anybody who remembers the war. And that is going to change the complexion of Europe and the relationship with the United States. And he was absolutely right. We have been complicit in the others rise in a positive way because we have worked with them. We have brought them in to the capitalist world, the world of entrepreneurism and market dynamics and so forth, from Japan to Germany to France to England and so forth. We've helped them. We've either revived them or taught them new skills. In the case of Japan, we have provided them the most important ingredient in the world if you're a nation. And that's national security. We have virtually provided it to them for half a century. Our nuclear umbrella and our willingness to spend until we're physically bankrupt to a certain extent has helped Japan for half a century. And I tell my Japanese colleagues that all the time, especially when they start telling me they're opposed to what Prime Minister Abe is doing today, trying to grow Japan up a little bit and shoulder a little more responsibility in this regard. Because we have provided the good, the public good of national security to a lot of people in the world. And I don't eliminate, if you'll allow me, Canada from that proposition. The West and Japan have had to spend much less on defense because the United States of America, empire that it is, was willing to spend a hell of a lot more. In fiscal year 2013, we spent $1.2 trillion, and I can demonstrate it to you account by account, on national security. Think about that for a minute. $1.2 trillion. We spent $600 billion on that five-sided puzzle palace called the Pentagon. We spent another $100 billion plus, it's classified, on our intelligence, 17 intelligence entities. Yes, 17. We spent around $40 to $50 billion on what's called Homeland Security, plus. We spent enormous amounts on nuclear weapons in the Department of Energy, enormous amounts which are growing every minute of every day on the Veterans Administration. And we spent a pittance on the last part I'll denominate here, the 150 account at the State Department, diplomacy. $1.2 trillion, with the predominant amount of that going, I would say, to hard power or the instruments of hard power. That's empire. That's imperial state. And our presidents, since the end of the Cold War, have found it a whole lot easier to make what I call fateful decisions. And my students and I define fateful decisions as those decisions a president makes to send young men and young women to die for state purposes. Or, and we forget this often, especially in my country, to kill other people for state purposes, or to risk your life in the process. And we look at it from two perspectives. We look at it from the perspective of war, what we used to call war. We call it conflict, hostilities, or some other euphemism today. Or covert operations, which are cheaper, but nonetheless for the people executing them just as much in harm's way. Ronald Reagan, for example, in 8 years of the presidency, conducted 58 covert operations, some of which we don't even know the details of today. By the time the American people have the details from the moratorium on classification being lifted, they won't care. It was 25 years before we knew of the complicity of the United States in the overthrow of the first democratically elected prime minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. Yes, we overthrew him. And then next year, we overthrew Arbenz in Guatemala. And I could go on and on. So that's the covert side of the use of this imperial power. Do you think we didn't have anything to do with the attempt to overthrow Hugo Chavez in Venezuela? We certainly did. I was there. Do you think we didn't have something to do with the recent turmoil in Kiev? You bet we did. Do you think we didn't have something to do with the turmoil that Russia finally reacted to in Georgia and Israel too? We certainly did. Do you think we didn't have anything to do with the turmoil in Damascus? We certainly did. We have not stopped conducting those 58 covert operations in 8 years just because we changed presidents, I'll guarantee you. So one might ask the question, what will the empire reveal in 10 or 12 years or 15 or 25 years? What will you learn about it in that regard? So in every meaningful way, we are an empire. If there's a unique part of it, I think, and my students talk about this a lot too, they wrestle with this question, it is that, as Colin Powell used to say, when we fight a war and we kill other people and we take their territory and we establish ourselves in their terrain, we don't ask for anything afterwards but enough land to bury our dead. That's very untraditional. So if you look at those beautiful cemeteries opposite the Normandy landing beaches in France or elsewhere in Europe, you understand what we ask for, a plot of ground for our people to lie in who sacrificed their lives. Increasingly, however, that sacrifice is even being questioned by the modern volunteer military, better titled the all-recruited military, $8 billion last year to recruit it. Increasingly, even they are asking questions about the imperialism and what it means and where they might lie in their grave should they be killed. I keep a portrait of a young William & Mary graduate in the back of my seminar room, 22 years old, brilliant young man. went to Afghanistan, and died there. And I constantly remind my students, and they hardly look me in the eye when I do this, that that is the ultimate price of your president's fateful decisions. Never whitewash it. Understand. And they know in their heart of hearts that most of the people who are in these foreign legions in the empire's military would be where they were if they were intellectually and more often financially capable of being there. But they're not. And so they're in the empire's military. So we have been complicit in this decline. It's not just natural that others' power is rising. It is also a fact of our having been strategically inept on a number of occasions. The one I'm most familiar with is the one I spent 12 years of my career dealing with in the military, and then had to deal with as a special assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, then Colin Powell, and then later had to deal with again as his chief of staff of the State Department, and that's Southwest Asia, the Middle East, and Iraq in particular. What did we do for all that time frame? And this is just to show you an example of what I'm talking about when I talk about our complicity in our decline. We, through realpolitik that you may agree with and disagree with, we can talk about that all day long, we maintained a balance of power in the Persian Gulf. Ever since FDR and the King of Saudi Arabia sat down and talked, we have been complicit in that balance of power. We, in the United States, and we generally in the West, have bought that deal. So we could have petroleum at a price that was affordable and not too disruptive in our economy. Indeed, fed and grew our economies. What did we do to maintain that balance of power? Well, first, we overthrew Mossadegh for the British, essentially, but the British probably would have had a lot of trouble accepting the Marshall Plan and growing themselves out of World War II's defeat, and we might say World War I's defeat, too. This was the death knell for the British Empire, after all. If we hadn't made sure that cheap oil in Iran kept coming to London. Some have estimated, people much smarter than I in this affair, that 40% of the British government's hard currency came from the Anglo-Iranian oil company. So now you know why they didn't want to give it up. Harry Truman told them, go to hell. There will be no U.S. complicity in the overthrow of Mossadegh. Dwight Eisenhower came in, a little wiser man, a little more astute, and a little more attuned to the necessities of the Cold War, and he said, okay, let's do it. He was also an Anglophile. He loved the British. He should have been. He was there a long time. So, we put the Shah in place, and for 26 years, he maintained for us the balance of power in the Persian Gulf. Protected our interests there. We didn't have to do too much. Whoa, the Iranians got tired of that. And in 79, as you well know, they overthrew that Shah. There's a real picture of ineptitude on the part of the United States. We didn't even predict it. And all of a sudden, we were out. Well, how do we reestablish the balance of power? Ah, let's take Saddam Hussein's side. Let's take Iraq's side. Let's balance the Arabs and the Persians. This is where I come on the scene. That's what I helped to orchestrate. As long as Tehran and Baghdad were opposed to one another, viscerally so in many respects, the balance was maintained. What do we do in 1991 when Saddam Hussein, well, let's go back a little bit to the bloodiest war in that region, the Iran-Iraq war, and the United States finally taking Iraq's side in that war. As you well know, we kind of played both ends against the middle in the beginning. Ronald Reagan tried to sell arms to the Iranian in order to get hostages back, diverted the money to the Contras in Nicaragua, and so forth and so on. So we played both sides of the game, but when it became apparent that Iran might win that war and thus disrupt the balance of power we'd so painstakingly maintained to that point, we took Iraq's side. And it wound up in Vincennes, our high-tech cruiser in the Gulf, actually shooting down an Iranian Airbus by mistake and killing 290 innocent Iranians. And the Ayatollah even said, we think from the records we've gotten from Iran, something like, I drank the hemlock and I quit. He agreed to end the war. He agreed to do what the UN wanted him to do and cease fire. And the reason was because he knew he couldn't defeat the United States. He could defeat Iraq, maybe, but not the United States. So the balance was restored. Argue with the way we did it. I once told my admiral when we reflagged Kuwaiti tankers in Operation Earnest Will in the Gulf, my admiral was talking on the phone, oddly enough, to Colin Powell, Ronald Reagan's national security advisor at the time. I once told my admiral, this is bad, we shouldn't do this. I don't care if the Russians are coming to the Gulf to do it, let them do it. They'll get so embroiled, it'll bring down their empire. And let's wait until there's only one Persian left and one Iraqi, and let's issue them dueling pistols. I mean, that's how cold-hearted I was about it. I was pure strategist. No, we had to take their side and so forth. Well, it worked until Saddam Hussein decided he'd go into Kuwait, and then we had to mount 500,000 men and women, build a coalition, and go over there and kick him out of Kuwait because we were really afraid he was going to turn right and go to Ras Tanura at 6 million barrels per day production capacity and disrupt that oil flow majorly. But it worked. We didn't go to Baghdad. We just restored the balance. And Dick Cheney, then Secretary of Defense, was 100% behind that, as was everyone else in the H.W. Bush administration. So now we come, fast forward, I'm Chief of Staff of the State Department. My boss is still Colin Powell, and we do it all over again, and we remove Saddam Hussein. Are you beginning to see the colors of the strategic ineptitude? So what choice do we have? We have two, basically. Three, we could say, to hell with the balance of power, we're going home. Let's see what happens. Or we could have said, we'll stay. We'll be the balancer. We quickly determined, quickly, you say it took a decade, but we nonetheless, I think, determined over time that that was really dangerous. Remaining in the region in force for a long time on the ground was really dangerous. We might actually fuse a lot of very disparate elements into a major opposition to what? Us. And every U.S. Marine and soldier would have a big red bullseye on his back, and every terrorist in the world would flock there to shoot that bullseye. So we moved ourselves out. What's the choice then? Well, you either go back when it turns into chaos again, which it most assuredly has done, or you quickly try to craft a new balance. How would you do that? Well, you would have a rapprochement with Tehran. You would have closer relations with Tehran. You would bring Iran back into the balance because she's the only country in the region, by the way, that's stable, reasonably prosperous, and I know you'll argue with this probably, but fairly well led. And she has a lot of democratic tendencies. She's very theocratic, but she has a lot of democratic tendencies. We once accepted her for 26 years when she had our tyrant at her helm, but now we have problems. Well, I think this administration is working secretly along those lines. Maybe not as fast as I'd like to see them work, but they are working that way. Or the other alternative, again, is go back. Go back and drag as many allies as you can with you. I watched some of the video of your parliament debating, and I watched the vote count and so forth. I was kind of surprised that it was so close. I thought it would probably be overwhelmingly for entering the fray. That kind of caution, I think, and some of the speeches that were made in opposition, which I heard just snippets of, were pretty smart and deliberate, and I think vouchsafed some truths. What are we going to do now, though? What's the empire going to do now? So let's just leave that for a moment. Glad to answer questions about it, but let's leave that for a moment and go back to my main theme. What is the empire going to do now? With or without allies, with or without UN legitimacy or whatever. What are we going to do now? Well, let's examine a few things. What scares me the most about the empire that really has nothing to do with this except indirectly? The first thing that frightens me is the disequilibrium of wealth. I got a new soundbite for that today, and I got it from a Frenchman and an article he wrote. And it's not Thomas Piketty, although I'd recommend Piketty to you. Capital in the 21st Century is his book. 400 people in the United States have a wealth that equals Brazil's gross domestic product. The government is bankrupt, but 400 people have a wealth that equals Brazil's gross domestic product. 1/1,000th of the United States, I'm not talking about the top 10%, not the top 1%, I'm talking about 1/1,000th owns 50% of the wealth of the United States. Throw income in there, throw the 10% in there, they own about 75%. That means the other 300 plus million get by on 25% income or wealth. Wealth being capital, stocks, shares, and so forth, and income being, of course, income. Staggering. How do you run a democracy? How do you run the midterm elections when Mitch McConnell can spend $100 million in Kentucky and flood a very impoverished state with money so he can be reelected? How do you do that? How do you maintain a democracy when you have that kind of disequilibrium? Piketty will tell you, with a meticulous research of the tax records of France and the United States, essentially that there are a lot of other points in his books that scare you to death. Like, for example, in the 21st century, he predicts we'll never exceed 3% growth. Not on the present economic profile. None of us will exceed 3% growth. Well, some of us may, but the aggregate will never be above 3%. Because we've hit it. We've hit it. We're finished in terms of the present economic model and growth. The old bugaboo, growth. The Chinese would be scared. If they've read Piketty, they're probably scrambling around the Central Party School now trying to figure out what to do. It's really frightening when you look at that aspect. But the aspect I want to highlight is what he found out about France and the United States, who have the most extensive tax records. If I'm not mistaken, and I recall correctly, France all the way back to 1789, the United States back to when we implemented the income tax around 1910, 1912. Guess what? Situation in the U.S. is 1929. Situation in France is 1789. Now maybe you understand a little bit of the problem that Hollande is confronting and France is confronting from an economic point of view. And a problem that we've masked and camouflaged with a vibrant stock market and a whole lot of return to prosperity of that top 1,000th, but not much for the rest. This is scary to me. You know, I've fought for my country. I've served my country. I understand a little bit, I think, about what I'm talking about, and it's very frightening. It's very frightening. The empire is in decline. The empire is in decline because of the rise of others' power, the BRIC nations, for example, India, China, Brazil, and so forth, but also because of its own ineptitude. And when that happens and the status quo and the preservation thereof becomes your principal goal in life, and you discard any innovation, any change, any mix of ingredients that you are not primus inter pares in, then you become your own worst enemy. And unfortunately, you drag a lot of good, self-respecting, decent, brave, patriotic themselves, competent allies with you. The latest example might be NATO. Are we going to go to war over the Ukraine? Well, they're not a NATO member. Not yet, anyway. We threatened to make them one. I'll tell you who is, though. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And a lot of the words that are coming out of Moscow right now look a lot like the words that came out of Moscow right before the fiat in Crimea. So is Putin serious about maybe protecting the Russian citizenry in those three countries, the Baltic states? And will he go as far as to use either covert operations or maybe more overt operations with real military involved? And what will we do in response? Well, I'll tell you what they'll tell me in Oklahoma City. Die for Riga? No chance. And people say, no, it can't happen, it can't happen. Go back and read about 1933, 1934, 1935, 1936, and so forth. People were saying the same thing then. People were saying the same thing then. We live in a dangerous world, and the empire is in decline. The empire that has provided public security for much of the West and Japan for 50 years is in decline. You can see signs of that if you look. You can see signs of that everywhere. You can also see signs of the strategic ineptitude and the bad decision making. It's almost a product of empire in decline. You become more and more desperate. You become more and more eager to preserve the status quo. You don't listen to people who argue contrary to your views. John Brennan and Jim Clapper, your intelligence chiefs, become the powerful gurus in your administration, and anything they tell you that makes you think that ISIS might be in Houston tomorrow makes you want to do things you would never have even calculated or contemplated doing 10 years before. Especially when you are a novice in the office. And we haven't had an expert in the office since Dwight Eisenhower. That's democracy. That's one of the weaknesses of democracy, especially a democracy that's constructed like ours, has a political process like ours, and has money flooding that process and determining more than anything else who holds the leadership positions. And you do away with all the inhibitions to war, and you transfer the war power, which is constitutionally in the legislature, to the executive. And that's exactly what we've done. That's what empires do. Empires don't have a Senate that debates war. Empires have a Caesar that goes to war. And that's what we've become. We have some good features still, of course. We have some good people still, of course. We have people who want to do something about what they see happening around them, physically and physically, morally, ethically, and in the form of realpolitik. They want to do something about it. They want better decision making. They want better action domestically and internationally. But so far, they have been unable to penetrate that status quo veneer that is woven now around the beltway in which I live, Washington, D.C. One of my Idaho friends with whom I trout fish in the Bitterroot Mountains said recently to me, a smart man, wealthy man, looked at me and he said, Washington can go to hell. We do not give a damn about Washington. And I encounter that attitude in a lot of places. Down in the Southwest, where they're going to dry up in the next decade, and they're going to have to change their entire lifestyle from Phoenix to the San Joaquin Valley, they're thinking finally about what they might do to adapt, because the water is leaving, and it is not coming back. They're either going to burn up or dry up, or both. Simultaneously. So they're thinking they need to do something, and they're trying to figure out what to do, but they're not looking to Washington to do it. So if there's a potential domestic way to resurrect the republic, as it were, it's probably going to be contrary to everything anybody would believe in this day and age. It's going to be the revivification of the states. It's going to be the power in the states taking on some of these problems and dealing with them and saying to hell with Washington. That's a hell of a kettle of fish, isn't it, for an empire? There was a book written about 20 years ago called The Nine Nations of North America. Guess what? One of them takes a little bit of your country, too, to make it. You know, the potential's there. The potential's there. I've had serious conversations with Texans, South Carolinians, Alabamans, Mississippians, and Georgians about leaving the Union. Serious conversations. They reconsider when they look at the deficit they would incur economically immediately and understand that California and New York and revenue transfers is the only reason they're economically salvageable. So they better come up with something other than German BMW and Mercedes plants in order to, you know, economically be sound if they're going to leave. Now that's way out in the future. But it is a distinct possibility, particularly when we confront, and I'm going to end on this, the most enormous challenge which the empire and the rest of us confront. And that's the fact that the earth, whether we're human inducing it or it's just natural, the science is clear. The earth has given us one millennium of really good life. It's getting ready to change, and maybe dramatically. We may see portions of Florida gone. We'll see Bangladesh gone. We'll see all kinds of changes. I remember when the president of Palau came into Admiral Crowe's office in 1984. And he was in the executive conference room and he looked at my admiral and he said, "Admiral Crowe, I have a question for you." And the admiral said, "Mr. President, we're here to address your questions." And he said, "What are we going to do when my island's gone? Where are you going to move me and my people?" Well, that's happening today. You know, it wasn't so far-fetched. Many of those South Pacific islands are going to disappear. Parts of Florida, Texas coast are going to disappear. North Carolina has already put money against moving some very pristine marshlands 2.5 miles inside their present location. That's very expensive and very difficult, very complex operation. But they've made the commitment to do it because they know they're going away. The salt water is going to rise and move into them and ruin them. So they're going to move them back some. This is reality. I've had some scenarios briefed to me by competent climatologists that say there might not be enough arable land for any more than maybe 1 billion people in terms of food production by as early as 2065. People say, "Oh, that's way out there." My grandchildren will still be alive, probably. This is the challenge, probably, of the planet. And we're finally, 30 years late, waking up to it in Washington. Dems and Republicans, finally waking up to it. Got a bunch of evangelicals out there yearning for the rapture who don't care. They want it to come. They think it's, you know, simultaneous with the Antichrist and so forth. There's about 48 million of these crazies. That crisis could have a silver lining. That crisis could forge the kind of cooperation and consensus both nationally in my country and ultimately globally, certainly regionally amongst, let's say, the top 20 initially, and then it's got to include the whole globe, might forge that kind of cooperation and consensus to meet this challenge over a sustained period of time that will bring out the leadership, bring out the innovation, bring out the clear thinking, bring out the strategic thinkers, bring out all that's necessary to not only revive the ship of state in my country, but to help the human race meet this challenge. And I don't say that grandiosely, because it is a challenge to the human race. And so far, we don't know of any others out there. There might be, but so far, we're the only ones. So this could be a very propitious time. Chinese have a saying, "May you live in interesting times." We do. I'm not going to see it. I'm going to be dead. But I really care about my grandchildren and my children, too, who might see the leading edge of this. And I want them to have at least as reasonable a prospect for a good life, a decent life, as I had. And the people who sacrificed for that, I'm beholden to. So that's why I think I'm a patriot. I'm not an abuser of empire or an abuser of my country. I really care about my country. People ask me why I'm still a Republican all the time. And I say, because I want the party of Lincoln back. Turn it loose. Get out of my party. Don't tell me to get out. That's why I stay there. And I hope we're having some progress in resurrecting at least an element of that party that'll have more sense over the next decade or two. So that's what I came to talk to you about. I'm finished talking now. I'd be glad to entertain your questions. And if I can entertain them on other subjects, specific subjects that are nonetheless a part of this tapestry, like ISIS, Syria, Ukraine, the Baltics, or whatever, I'd be glad to do so, whatever your interest is. And I would ask you, if you could, if you want to ask a question, there are microphones at the end of each aisle here. Just come to those microphones and ask away. I'm told we also have some people out there who are listening through other mechanisms, and they may have some questions on the screen here, so if there's one there, I'll try to go to it too. Yes, you had a question? Or are you, okay, I thought you were the first one. Come on, you know, I've said some provocative things. I know you're out there cogitating over them. Who is this dude? Please ask me.
Sure. When we were having dinner beforehand, I was asking you about your perspective on the rationale for the new military invention in Iraq that Canada is now going to be a part of, and whether the basis for it was more thoughtful, perhaps, than it was. You talked about the ineptitudes of the past, and you had some thoughts about that, about whether there's more careful thinking now, more ideas about the long-term strategic interests and the possible exit strategy. Can you talk about that?
Surely. Everybody heard that?
No.
In essence, he's asking, are the president and his advisors in what they're doing against ISIL in Iraq and Syria right now acting more wisely than what I've kind of depicted in the past? My answer would be yes, but I'd qualify that answer. I don't know where they're going. I don't know to what strategic purpose they're doing what they're doing. If they're doing it essentially to reintroduce U.S. and whatever else will go, ground forces in the region, if that's their ultimate goal, convince the American people who now are very much against that. Polls show they're okay with the bombing, but they're not okay with recommitment of ground forces. If they're going to work the American people into the fervor that they'd need to work them into, largely through the politics of fear, and watch that very closely, you know, this Khorasan group, this Al-Qaeda group plotting to attack the United States. I went straight to my intelligence contacts, the ones I respect and trust, both active and retired. And you never retire from the intelligence community. And I said, any truth? You notice the president hadn't mentioned them again? This was really good for getting American people to push those polls up for action. But the Khorasan group, no one can tell me who they are or what they are, other than, oh, it's about 50 al-Qaeda that Zawahiri sent down there to plan to attack the United States. Well, I would suspect that Zawahiri, al-Qaeda's leader now, Ayman al-Zawahiri, probably sent them down there to make sure the Islamic State was not doing things that he didn't want them to do, or try to control some of the elements in the Islamic State that are not terrorists. Not terrorists. What do I mean by that? Do you really think that terrorists are out there manning main battle tanks? Something that takes the United States Army a year to train someone to do? Manning the late model Soviet main battle tanks and pumping rounds into Kobani? That's Sunnis from Iraq. That's the same Sunnis that David Petraeus awakened in 2007 and convinced them to attack the al-Qaeda elements in Iraq, who incidentally predominantly had come from other places we disturbed, like Libya, Cyrenaica, the greatest producer of recruits for al-Qaeda in Iraq, and got them, along with the Sunnis, whom we had essentially disbanded the military of and essentially sent out into the deserts to attack us mercilessly, to agree to stop that, get rid of al-Qaeda, and come join in a government in Baghdad. And they did. And what did Maliki do, Nouri al-Maliki, our ruler in Baghdad? Well, he put them in prison, he murdered them, and he kicked them out of all political power. So what do you think they're doing now? ISIS forces didn't take Mosul. They were on the surface of it. The Sunnis did. Guess who's paying for that, too? Saudi Arabia. Ooh, Joe Biden spoke the truth? You bet he did. And he had to apologize for it, of course. I hope that was orchestrated. I hope the president said, why don't you go out and tell the truth, Vice President, and then we'll reprimand you, but we'll get it out there. People start thinking about it, including the people in Riyadh. Because we know what they're doing. Powell used to describe the Saudis this way. There's a horse race. There's three horses pulling out ahead. Saudis pack all their money on those three horses. Watch the race, watch the race, watch the race. One horse is pulling out in the lead, in the lead, in the lead. Put all their money on that horse. That's Saudi strategy. That's what they do. So they're backing the very people they're now helping us bomb. Although I have to tell you, I haven't seen a single fighter jet or fighter bomber with a Saudi decal on the side of it. That's how complex this situation is. Extremely complex. So the answer to your question is yes, but to what purpose? I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen it revealed. That's an excellent question, and it's my greatest fear. It's my greatest fear. It's like I tell my students, when you leave here, you'll owe $100,000. Do you think you're ahead? yes, there are dire consequences. If you've listened to some of the people who've gone public lately, one of them viral on the internet, I'm not sure how much to believe him, though. He's one of the principal advisors to what the CIA calls its Futures Project, where it does a report for 2025, 2030, and so forth. It looks out to the future. And that's not just the CIA. Now, under the DNI, it's the National Intelligence Council, which is really the whole intelligence community feeding into that, into the NIC. He says that what he sees around the world, and he's, you know, told the intelligence community this, and they're now using their very sophisticated assets to measure this, and I know they're sophisticated. I've used them with them against North Korea, principally, to see if what he's saying is true. That is to say that gold is being moved in sort of unique ways, concentrated in secret and unique ways, and capitals are slowly but surely but methodically divesting themselves of U.S. treasuries. That Beijing and Moscow are both complicit in this, and that what they're trying to do is weaken the dollar. So what you see right now in the supposed strengthening of the dollar is really a false impression. What they want to do is what we did essentially when we abandoned the gold standard, and then oil really became the standard because oil is demarcated and sold in dollars principally. What they want to do is use Putin and others' oil power, petrodollars, if you will, and I say that petro-yuan, petro-renminbi, petro-euro, whatever, to force the United States to lose its incredibly powerful role as owning the world's transactional action reserve currency. If that happens, a similar thing will happen to what Dwight Eisenhower threatened the British with in the IMF when they invaded Suez with the French and the Israelis. The real powerful move that Ike made was to threaten a run on the pound. Eden had to back off. He had to back off. He couldn't take that. So what we're looking at is a possible use by others in the world of our dependence on the dollar to give us so much power that we otherwise wouldn't have. Charles de Gaulle once said it was vicious what we did after the war, when we had the world's currency, and take that power away from us. And the debt increases enormously the capability to do that. And the debt is staggering, if you think about it. If you just look at it and you understand what the Fed's been doing in terms of quantitative easing and just printing more and more money, the only reason you do that is because you own the world's transactional currency. You can print money and money and money, and you don't do what Mobutu did, for example, drive inflation up to 300,000%. Or, for example, what the Germans had happened to them in the 30s, where they, you know, the old adage of pushing a wheelbarrow full of marks in order to buy a loaf of bread. Could it get that bad in the empire? Yes, it could, especially if the rest of the world decides that that's a good thing to do and to go along with it, or decides it has to do it. It has to use euros or yen, or let's just call on special drawing rights at the IMF, something the Chinese kind of like. Could you create something other than currency to be that to which everyone goes in a crisis? Yes, you could. Special drawing rights would be just that at the IMF or wherever they might reside. So these things are changing in the world, I think, because people are losing confidence in the empire. Our enemies, and some of our friends are losing confidence in the empire. The Saudis have totally lost confidence in the empire. And you can say it happened after Mubarak, and we didn't back Mubarak. They saw the same thing for themselves in similar circumstances, and they said, we can no longer trust the United States. Goodbye, United States. And that's why Prince Bandar has been running around with a bucket full of money funding Islamic State forces. That, plus they want a Sunni region and not a Shia region. They want to overthrow Bashar al-Assad because he's a real Shia stalwart, and they want to overthrow, ultimately, the Shias in Tehran. They don't want the Shia in their own country, very restive and treated like blacks were in the 50s in our country. You know, they don't want them overthrowing them. So this is very complex, it's very complicated, but debt makes it very dangerous. And debt is the thing I'm most frightened of. All empires, I think, in history who've disappeared abruptly have had a physical problem at the end. You know, the Romans, as they were transferring from the west to the east, and as they gained a new advocate, a new disciple in Christianity, and as they moved into Constantinople and so forth, the Romans were printing, or not printing, but they were coining coins that were so worthless. Reminds me of our quarters today when you look at it. A little silver here, a little silver there, and the copper in between. You know, they were coining. Their coinage was so worthless, it was incredible. And yet, because of the residual power, they were able to get away with that. I'm not saying we're in that dire straits, but I am saying that debt is very worrisome. Physical profligacy is very worrisome. What did Chuck Hagel just try to do with the Overseas Contingency Fund? And I've been a friend of Chuck Hagel's for 20 years, our Secretary of Defense. Congress even objected to it, those pusillanimous people over there. He tried to use that warfighting fund to buy some more F-35 Lightning strike fighters. Wow, it's already not appropriated money and therefore not going through oversight. It's just handed money. Here, have a check. So he wants to now say, oh, well, you know, the urgency under which George W. Bush got that money from you, and I'm getting that money from you now, war, is going to be sort of adumbrated into, hey, I need to buy some Lockheed strike fighters. So a diversion of funds that have already been diverted. This is not what sane and sober empires do. Yes?
If it's true that empire is in decline, what amount of time, amount of energy does the current president, presumably the next president, spend on Russia? You mentioned Russia, on Putin. That's part one. And then part two, do Latvians, Estonians, and Lithuanians, are their fears justified, given what's been happening in Russia the last year?
Last part of your question, I think yes, but it all depends on how far Putin's willing to go. I'm hoping that he's got a sane and sober element to him, too. First part of your question is more difficult. What do you do? When Ukraine was not a member of NATO, not yet. But these three states are. So what do you do? Some of you look like you, this is no insult, I am. Look like you might be old enough to remember Die for Danzig? Or Die for Pilsen? Or whatever, you know, Die for Prague? Die for Riga? I guarantee you that if I walk up to the average American citizen and I explain to them the situation with Article 5 in the NATO Treaty, first of all, they won't know what I'm talking about. And then I'll explain to them an attack on one is an attack on all. Constitutional processes, yeah, but we don't have a constitutional process. President goes to war. Libya? Didn't even consult the Congress. Secondly, they'll say, where's Riga? And then they'll say, you mean we might go to war in a way that might recall conscription, require mobilization of 2 or 3 million men and women, and ultimately devolve to nuclear weapons? Count me out. So if you're president, how do you react when you know that that's the way the American people are going to react? I would ask you to examine your hearts and your souls, too. Are you willing to die for Riga? and give me an honest answer. This is the dilemma when you start doing things as ineptly as we have done. Why is Putin doing what he's doing? Well, partly because it's the only way he can hold on to power and get 60% ratings in the polls in Moscow. But it's partly, too, because we reneged on George H.W. Bush and Jim Baker's promise to Edward Shevardnadze, then the foreign minister of the Soviet Union becoming Russia, and to Gorbachev and later to Yeltsin. And these are almost Jim's verbatim words, that in exchange for their not raising any hue and cry over the most monumental diplomatic achievement of the late 20th century, the reunification of Germany, that we would not go one further inch east, those are Jim Baker's words, with NATO. What did Bill Clinton do? He didn't go one step further east. He went countries further. And he even contemplated, and Obama kept it up, Georgia and Ukraine. We even fomented the revolution in Kiev. What was Putin to do? One third of the Soviet military's heavy armament comes from Ukraine. Their most important naval bases are in Sevastopol and Odessa. Odessa might be next. It's actually more strategic than the Crimea. What was he to do in the face of such a taunt, in the face of such a challenge? Now the question is, will he go further? And what will we do if he does? I don't know. I can't answer that question. I've exhausted your questions. Yes, please.
The phones don't seem to work, so it's all right if I don't interrupt everybody seating and ask from here.
I can hear you.
You mentioned Arbenz in Guatemala. CIA goes in and overthrows Arbenz because he was going to take land away from the United Fruit Company and Alan Dulles didn't like that.
You got it.
And 50 years of violence and genocide occur after that. It proves that the West has a tremendous capacity to go into a country and screw everything up worse than it was when they went in. We were for Hussein before we were against him, for Gaddafi before we were against him, for the Mujahideen before we were against Al-Qaeda. How does the West stop creating the enemies of our future?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, it's an excellent question. I clap for you too. You know, you're going to think my answer strange, perhaps, but there was once a gentleman in the White House who actually wanted to empower the UN to the extent that he was willing to turn over nuclear weapons and to the extent he was willing to have an open skies agreement with the Soviet Union, that is to say they could fly over us and we could fly over them anytime we wanted to. His name was Dwight Eisenhower, and he was probably the last president we had who was experienced enough to qualify for the job. He didn't do everything right. He was the one that went through these series of coups, for example. But I can excuse him in the face of what he thought was communist aggression, communist inroads, you know, rollback, containment, all that thing. It's easy to look back in retrospect and say, well, it wasn't all that big a threat, and, you know, you didn't really need to sacrifice all these people to thwarting that threat. That's easy to do today. I try to be a little more kind to him. But we don't see people with that kind of courage and that kind of boldness anymore. I served an administration that essentially said, to hell with the rest of the world, with the exception of my boss. And I watched what happened when we said that to the Germans, to the Japanese, to the French, oh my God, you know. And I remember what the president said in the Oval Office with his feet up on the desk about Chancellor Schroeder in Germany. And I remember what my boss said when he got back to the State Department. One of the most important relationships in the transatlantic field, and we just ruined it. And then he quickly called Joschka Fischer, who was then the foreign minister, and for the next 4 years they worked under the table to keep the U.S.-German relationship solid and alive. They shared cooking, beer, all kinds of things. Midnight in the secretary's office, I could get a good German beer. You got to have people like that. You got to have people who really think international cooperation, international criminal justice, all the things that we pretend to be the leader of are indeed worth leading and are a better course of action than dropping bombs on people. Until we get a leadership like that, it isn't going to happen. And I don't know how you get that kind of leadership. So that's not a very good answer. Good question, though.
Sir.
Yes.
President Eisenhower is also the one who warned in his one page last speech about the military industrial complex. Now, has that come to fruition? Have we seen the results of that occurring now in the United States?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. I think it's gone beyond what even his imagination would conjure. Just as I think, let's take a look at George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and their messages with regard to never letting, and John Quincy Adams, never letting the United States interest become so wrapped up in another state's interest that that state's interests were seen as ours, Israel. Think Israel. Very distorting in American foreign policy. Physically distorting, too. We used to look at our budget in the State Department and we'd say, okay, $3 billion to Israel, $3 billion to Egypt, and so they don't attack Israel. What do we got left? Wow, nothing. Yes, it's an excellent question, and yes, the answer to it is the military-industrial congressional complex is alive and well and sucking the blood out of the empire. Raytheon stock shares go through the wall when we shoot million-dollar cruise missiles at a terrorist carrying a $200 AK-47. Donald Rumsfeld even asked the question. You know, he put it this way. He said, tell me, to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, he said, tell me how we are winning when every time we kill one of them, we create six more. He didn't even talk about the cost effectiveness of expensive weapons against cheap ones. But it's the same metaphor, you know. How do you win when you strike with a drone, two terrorists, and kill 30 civilians? And the people around say, at least six or seven of them, I'm becoming a terrorist. And you suddenly got more recruits. And let me tell you another thing that was just revealed to me in Syracuse, Sicily, where I was at a conference 2 weeks ago on international criminal justice, by the UN individual, an Indonesian, responsible for what the UN is calling terrorist rehabilitation. My first reaction to his revelations to me was, wow, we got something like that at the UN? He said, yeah, and my main countries to monitor right now, because they have up and running and very robust terrorist rehabilitation programs, is Saudi Arabia. Scared me to death. You know, rehabilitate them, put them back on the battlefield. And Indonesia and Malaysia. And then he said what really struck me. Until about 3 weeks ago, he said, and he'd interrogated in prison and out as they were being rehabilitated about 200 of these terrorists. Jamaa Islamiya, Abu Sayyaf, Al-Qaeda, Lashkar-e-Taiba, you name the atrocious group. He had talked to some of them. And they said the major recruiting tool for them was Guantanamo. Think about that for a minute. Rumsfeld's proposition writ large, until 3 weeks before he was talking to me. And I said, well, what is it now? He said, Gaza and the deaths there and the United States' absolute inattention to and uncaring attitude towards those deaths. Now, you can say, oh, that's not all true. You know, there's more to it than that. But that's not what the 22-year-old with no prospects, no job, no nothing for a future, and an AK in his hand, and three or four mullahs talking to him about jihad, that's not what he thinks. What he thinks is 3,000 Tunisians, 1,500 Moroccans, I got intelligence on, have just shifted over out of Morocco, out of Tunisia, and they've joined the Islamic State forces. That's late-blooming intelligence, if you will. You've got to stop this recruiting. You've got to go after the heart of it. Yes, please.
Yes, I'm curious, knowing a little bit about your background as a military man and advisor, what you think about the strategy now, even though you're very close to the administration, why would Obama and his advisors repeat the same errors of bombing indiscriminately, well, maybe not indiscriminately, but you mentioned cruise missiles and taking out one guy with an AK-47, knowing the collateral damage, which means huge numbers of civilians will be killed. Hence, we get, you know, the whole thing going over again, more recruits coming from elsewhere in the world. Why did they decide on this bombing strategy now, and our Canadian government has decided to wait and do exactly the same thing on a very much smaller scale, of course, but I'm curious as to your evaluation of that strategy. Is it going to work? And what should they have done if that is the wrong strategy?
I'll have to give you an answer that comes from talking with some military colleagues and my own surmises, but the information I've gotten from the military is probably more trustworthy in this case. Their expectations are that the airstrikes, just as they've said, the airstrikes will be sufficient to put some steel in the spines of first the Iraqis, and then maybe even others in Syria, like the Turks, for example, and show them that there is support, at least from the air, for their indigenous forces, which really ought to be doing the heavy lifting. And the hope and expectation is that that will excite these indigenous forces. We're even sending General Allen over as the overall coordinator to make sure, and Saudi Arabia's going to do a lot of the training. That scares me again. But these ground forces, get them back into shape, principally in Iraq, but also eventually in Syria, so that they can handle the forces that are arrayed against them. At the same time, and this is a more important ingredient, and I'm almost positive the administration is working on it feverishly in secret, you've got to get the political structure in Baghdad to be inclusive. The current guy, blessed by Iran and blessed by the United States, that was the first cooperative effort, if you will, towards this problem, has to be inclusive. He has to include those Sunnis who are now supporting the Islamic State forces in the political structure in Baghdad and ultimately in the sharing of political power in Iraq. And he has to include the Kurds too in a way that has so far been rather alienating for them. They picked up on that and they like it because they'd like an autonomous state up there, or they'd like a state up there. I don't think they're going to get anything but maybe the autonomous state. In that situation, I think it's workable. If that'll just happen over the next 2 to 3 years, it's workable. And the airstrikes make sense to start it. Let's look at Syria, though. That's a different problem altogether. Huge mistake we made when President Obama listened to Samantha Powers and Susan Rice and said, it's another Mubarak, say he's unacceptable, get rid of him. And he did. Big mistake. He's not Mubarak, Syria is not Egypt, and Assad is going to be around. He's proved it. He has a sizable support base in Syria. Interestingly, the way this whole thing got started, I'm told by people a lot more expert than I am in Syria, is water shortages and the marches by the farmers, some 200,000, on Assad forces, basically unarmed, because of those water shortages. Saudi Arabia saw a wonderful chance to intervene, saw forces arrayed against Assad that they might could arm and propagandize, so began sending heavy weapons and foreign fighters, the Islamic State, think, into Syria. And this all coalesced into an armed opposition to Assad. Meanwhile, we're sitting around twiddling our thumbs, wondering what the Saudis are doing, and all of a sudden, wow, boy, this looks great. Let's find the moderates amongst them and support them. There aren't any moderates amongst them. The most moderates amongst them are expatriates living in the United States who are railing and hollering, just as Ahmad Chalabi did for Iraq, for us to get over there and run everybody out so they can take power. This is a very complex situation that if you don't get the Turks involved in a serious way, and not just to kill Kurds or watch Kurds being killed in front of their guns, but to actually threaten, if not actually do something, with regard to the Islamic State forces who are now killing the Kurds for them, and you don't get Iranians involved in terms of their support for Assad, but turning that support into a more cooperative effort to bring a political solution and ultimate stability to this area in this war, bring refugees back, and so forth. And at the same time, you don't deal forthrightly with the greatest refugee problem since World War II, you're not going to solve it, and much more than that. I had occasion in Sicily to run into King Hussein, the former king of Jordan, now deceased, of course, to run into his younger brother. And he came up to me and he said, I want you to tell Colin I miss him and, you know, give him my warmest regards and everything. And he said, can I talk to you for a minute? And I said, certainly you can, Your Majesty. And he said, do you know, putting his finger in my chest, he said, do you know there is a refugee family in every single home in Jordan? Do you know how destabilizing that is for my little state? He's right. Look at Lebanon. Look increasingly at the periphery of Syria, and you see the same thing. This is a terrible problem about which my country is doing almost nothing. It needs to do something. And so does everybody else, for that matter. We need to do something about this. We need to help the UN. We need to help the refugees, money, food, whatever it takes. We need to help these states that are taking the burden on themselves, like Jordan, to do this. Humanitarian relief. We supposedly do that well. It's not killing people, that's helping people. But Syria is much more complex, so it's really hard to answer your question with regard to Syria. We probably need to be talking to Assad, too. I think we are. At least we're talking to his people. But we need to be talking about a political accommodation that might even envision Assad staying around for a while. Wow. In the United States, too much. Too much. From a number of perspectives. When I can go to the Congress essentially trying to convince them to support the president on his negotiations with Iran and encounter an individual who tells me the earth is 6,248 years old and he will brook no opposition, I know I have a problem. And that's a true story. When I can go to Patrick Henry College in Purcell, Virginia, and talk to its chancellor, and he tells me that his whole purpose in life, the reason he put $2 billion into that campus, his whole purpose in life is to train hard-minded Christians for Christ to go into the military and the government, and then I understand what his agenda is, your question means something. We have a real problem in the United States. I'm involved in something called the Military Religious Freedom Foundation out in Santa Fe. Every day, we have 38,000 clients in the armed forces of the United States. 90% of them are Christians. Got a few atheists. We got a few agnostics. We got a few Jedi Knights. We got a few Wiccans. And they come to us with stories you wouldn't believe. Do you know what happened to me yesterday, said 1E6 yesterday? In an email to Mikey Weinstein, the head of the organization, I'm on the advisory board. He sends me the emails. I just got a solicitation from the commanding general of my post to come to a prayer meeting. Wow. Read the Constitution lately, General? You don't have the authority to do that. And oh, by the way, you're violating the law and the Constitution doing that. You cannot proselytize. You cannot suggest from your position of rank and superiority that your troops should go to a dominionist Christian megachurch and worship. 38,000 plus clients right now, on a legal basis or otherwise, mostly through anonymity because they know what the command chain would do to them if they found out what they're complaining about. This is serious. It's serious. At the Air Force Academy, it's such a recurring problem that we've actually had parents at orientation week get up, grab their children by the arm, and drag them out of the orientation and take them home and say, "You're enrolling in something other than the United States Air Force Academy, kid, or I'll kill you." There's a sect called the Dominionists. It's a small sect within the evangelical community, and its purpose in life. Google them. Google Dominionists and read their purpose. To take over the armed forces of the United States and defeat the enemies of Christ and bring about Armageddon and the flaming sword and the killing of all the unbelievers. They're in missile silos, battalions, squadrons, and on ships. And the military will not talk about it much. They know they got a problem, but they don't want to publicize it. It's like sexual assault. It's like suicide. It's like post-traumatic stress. They've become public, not because the military made them public, but because they couldn't stop them from becoming public. The stats in the military right now are just astonishing on suicides and sexual assault. Something like 1 in 4 women in a 3-year tour will be raped or assaulted in some way. Something like 1 in 10 men will be raped or assaulted by another man. This isn't sex, this is crime. This is assault. It's part of the warp and woof of what you do when you create a military that is so divorced from the rest of your community. When you don't ask citizens to shoulder a responsibility to the state and you take on the power of the security of half the world. You can't do that and get away with it, not for long. Yeah, it's a problem, significant problem. I've been told by Canadians from, you know, this community and in Toronto that you don't have such a problem. I've asked the question, you don't have such a problem as we do. You're fortunate in that respect. We really have a problem with messianic religion. Yes?
I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about
ISIS. I'm a Christian, by the way.
More about ISIS. I guess if you commit to troops to this war effort, they obviously have a lot of trepidation. Who, I mean, tell us more about who they are, and are they as big a threat as our press would have us believe? These terrorists running around cutting people's head off and causing massive fear in the whole Middle East.
Yeah. I think we've hyped the threat in order to get action and to get support, yes. But I do think the threat's there. I think it's genuine. And I think it's composed of a number of elements, some of which have simply gotten out of control. The first is the Saudi support for Wahhabism, madrasas that support Wahhabism and Salafists, and that sort of thing, that creates young men who really want to do jihad and are willing to commit suicide to do it. The second is this disgruntled element throughout the region that is subject to being recruited, but isn't really that violent-minded, that masochistic, whatever you want to say, but has an allegiance to Islam in its perspective. The Quran is read differently from others, perhaps, and takes the responsibility as a liberating thing. I think you probably have some Canadian citizens, and we have some citizens and others who feel this way about it. It's liberating. I can finally do something about all the oppression, repression, the crime, and everything else, principally against Islam. I can do something about it. Let's go fight. We're finding out right now that a lot of these young people, after about 6 months, are very disenchanted and would like to get away from it, but they can't because their commanders will slit their throat if they try to get away. Or they go into the desert and desert, and then things are just as bad, probably. So it's not something that is cohesive in the sense that it's going to grow and, as some people are saying, come into the soft underbelly of Europe, join the fifth column that's already in Europe, in Brussels and Paris and everywhere else, and forge a force that will bring Islam back in a big way, the dominant religion in the world, the caliphate, if you will. I think that's all bull. But the things that accompany it are dangerous, especially attracting this basically young population all over the region and to a certain extent in the world that's disenchanted, sees no prospects. One person put it this way, in Egypt, in Cairo. You know what this young man wants? He wants two meals a day, a roof over his head, a prospect for a job, a prospect for a family, clean water to drink, and a lasting ceasefire. None of that is even envisionable. Therefore, he's going to go to Tahrir Square, and he's going to fight. Ultimately, he's going to fight. You don't cure that by dropping bombs. You cure that by taking those incentives away, by development, by economic help, all manner of things that you do through soft power to take away the incentive to join that black flag. You'll never take it away from Zawahiri and Al-Qaeda types and those who form the core, but you can certainly take it away from the majority of them, and then you've got a manageable problem. When people said in 2001, we're going to have a war on terror, you know, bad, bad, bad expression. Not only can you not fight a technique, it's bad just as the war on drugs is bad. I told my boss in 1989, Colin Powell, Forces Command Commander, why would you want to call it a war on drugs? Because you're going to lose it. Why would you want to get involved in a war you know you're going to lose? Don't call it a war. Call it the military aiding civilian law enforcement to prevent the infiltration of illegal narcotics into the United States. Call it anything you want to, but don't call it a war on drugs. That's stupid. We're losing. We've lost. It's done. It's toast. We finished. We've ruined Mexico. So don't call it a war on terrorism. You're never going to eliminate terrorism. It'll always be there as a political instrument for somebody somewhere. But you've got to get it down to a manageable level so that everybody in the world's not fearful of getting on the metro tomorrow morning or going into a Walmart. You got to get it down to a manageable level. The way you do that is not by dropping bombs. You do it by taking care of the incentives that are putting most of the people in the fight.
Every few years we have another war in the Middle East, in Gaza, around Israel. So that the war is now off of center stage. What's going on? Is there any reason to think something awful is happening? Is there something happening behind the scenes that maybe we don't know? Or is there any prospects that
not as long as Bibi Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman and their like are in control of the political process in Tel Aviv. I'm convinced now. I wasn't for a long time, but I am convinced now, and I'll say it. I think their goal is a greater Israel. They not only want the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and portions of Syria. They want the Sinai back. They want Jordan. They want whatever they can get their hands on, and they see, this is the leadership, they see this current turmoil as a chance to do some of this. And they would like the United States to take the greatest possible opponent they have out of the equation. Iran has not really much to do with nuclear weapons. It has with their fear of the United States affecting a rapprochement with Tehran and therefore putting Israel in a back seat. It's geostrategic, geopolitical. It's not nuclear. But we've made it nuclear. And to answer your question directly, no, I don't see any hope. I told an EU audience recently who were just puzzled as hell as to why Washington couldn't seem to diverge from Israeli interests. I said, don't count it on any time soon. Whatever Israel wants, Washington will do, no matter what the rhetoric. Now, this president has, like George H.W. Bush, he has said some things recently that really pissed Netanyahu off. But follow through? I just don't see it. Not as long as the electorate and the Congress in particular, you know, kind of put manacles on him with regard to Israel. It's the strangest relationship I've ever seen in my 70 years on this earth. I do not understand it. 65% of American Jews object to Netanyahu's policies. J Street, Jeremy Ben-Ami's alternative to AIPAC, PAC, is growing by leaps and bounds. He's got millions of dollars under his belt now. But he still can't buy off congressmen. I'll tell you a story. I'll tell you a story his financial director told me. Please don't repeat this.
So I'm going to suggest we're going to go one more question.
Let's say that a person told me that they offered to one congressman, they did it this way. They said, Mr. Congressman, we understand you got this much money from AIPAC last year. We'll put two more zeros on it. And he looked at him without blinking and said, no deal. So it's not necessarily about money. It's about everything from shame over the Holocaust to an idea that permeates the American fabric that Israel is the bastion we will go land on if we really have to go to war. The unsinkable aircraft carrier, the old Cold War feeling about Israel in the Middle East, to occasionally a feeling that, hey, this really is all about the Bible. I mean, it's a whole gamut of things, but it's really strange.
So, Professor, I'm going to suggest we take one more question.
Sure.
I've been reminded by your group that you have some more travels tonight.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So why don't we, is there one more question that someone would like to ask?
How about up there? I do. I see a number of successors. Canada, Germany, France, Japan, Britain. I see a number of them. Spain, you know, Italy. I see a lot of successors. I'm not being that facetious. I would like to see a more widespread shouldering of responsibility for global security, regional security too, local security, if you want to call it that, with respect to terrorists who might infiltrate us. At the same time, I see wiser decision-making. So what I'm saying is that you would recruit these allies to more responsible, more burden sharing by making them and proving to them by your actions, making wiser decisions about when and where you do use force or threaten the use of force. And then gather them about you and say, you know, essentially you've got to do more. You've got to do more. Japan is now looking as if, for its own reasons perhaps, but nonetheless, I think it has something to do with the security relationship, China and so forth, is making signs that it's going to do that. I think Germany has to do that. I think France has to do that. England has to do that. Others in the fight, so to speak, have to do that. And it has to be more than it is primus inter pares, it has to be pares inter pares. And we have to share the burden of security financially and fielding forces. That means a lot of things that the United States doesn't like to do. It means real sharing of technology and secrets. It means real, what I would call combined training. It means real efforts to have a force that's not just the United States, but a real alliance, whether it's an alliance of convenience and time or an alliance that lasts like NATO has for some years, probably the most successful political and military alliance in human history. I think that's the way you do it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for a very good question.
Just a few quick remarks before we adjourn, if I may. First of all, I want to thank Professor Wilkerson again for his remarks this evening. It's always a pleasure at CG to have people who speak from real expertise, real experience, and we certainly heard that here tonight. Your remarks were called the travails of empire, and you certainly did walk us through history and through the challenges facing the U.S. empire as you've described it, but could easily have been called the travails of species, since you also warned us about the dangers of climate change and challenges and struggles that face all of us. Many of these scenarios are very dire, including climate change, but also your fear of fiscal debt and other security issues, and yet you seem like a very happy fellow. And I think it must be because I hear in your remarks also a belief in good policy that emerges from leadership, from informed peoples, from learning the lessons of the past, and from coalitions of willing people to come together and find solutions when there's crisis. So we'll take hope from that, and thank you once again for your messages tonight. Thank you. And I want to remind our audience that the edited video will be posted to the CG website and a blog about this event where you can add your own comments. And we invite you to come to two more public events in the CG auditorium this month. On Wednesday, October 15th, we continue the cinema series with E-Team, a documentary following four members of the emergencies team of Human Rights Watch. And on Wednesday, October 9th, Professor Thomas Homer Dixon from the Balsley School of International Affairs will speak about Canada as a resilient energy superpower, one that has more to offer the world than the oil sands, cleaner alternatives in an era of climate change. So register for these events online, and be sure to subscribe to our newsletter on all of our upcoming events. Thank you for coming to CG. Have a safe journey home.